This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Tuesday, so it's time for our crack strategy panel. And as always, there's a lot to talk about. Finance Minister Rod Phillips will unveil his fall economic statement tomorrow. What can we expect? And given that the Ford government has backtracked on many of their cutbacks plans, will we see those, quote, efficiencies touted during the election? And where will they come from? And what about this kindler, gentler Dolfo, who is now presenting himself as a unifier and offering to organize a premier's meeting here to make peace between the West and the East? And on the federal scene, Elizabeth May has stepped down as leader of the Green Party. That was expected. Yes, she has personal reasons, but is it also because she didn't make the gains many expected in the last election? Of course, we want to hear from our audience. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. I'd like to welcome Karen Stintz, former Toronto City Councillor and current CEO of Variety Village, and Aleem Kanji, Vice President of Government Relations at Sutherland Corporation, and Michael Diamond, Principal of Upstream Strategy Group. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
All righty, let's start with Karen here in the studio. So what are you expecting in the fall economic statement?
Well, I think that it will be a more stay the course type of statement that I think there has been some step backs from some of the cuts that were being proposed, which I think are reasonable. And but I think it will really be hold steady approach, and I don't think we're going to see any major new announcements, and I don't think there's going to be many surprises.
It was interesting that shortly before we went to air, the Liberals had a news conference, and Mitzi Hunter, the former education minister who's running for the leadership, they said, we expect the deficit to go down, and the Ford government has to come clean and admit that we, the Liberals, left the economy in great shape, and that's why we are going to see gains. Michael, is that a winning argument?
Well, I don't think anyone's going to believe Mitzi Hunter on matters of what a strong economy is, so I don't think it's a particularly strong announcement, but I think as strong arguments. But I think Karen makes very good points. You know, it's important to remember last year's fall economic statement was the first time the new government, after 15 years, really had a chance to showcase a fiscal agenda. We're not going to be seeing that tomorrow, would be my guess, because, of course, they've been able to introduce a budget, and they've been in government for over a year now, so it won't be quite as big of an event as it was last year, but I think it will be really a plan that will be unveiled to show balance across the board, balance in spending, balance in returning to balanced budget, and balance in building the problem.
Aleem, I mean, this comes at a time where, on the one hand, say with teachers' unions, they're being accused of making very damaging cuts, and on the other, on the right, people are saying they haven't cut enough. They've backtracked from everything they planned to do. So where are they at?
Well, this is one of the things we're going to hear about in the economic statement tomorrow. We know that the numbers are going to be a lot more favorable than they expected. And that is attributable to larger than expected revenues. Let's face it. The economy and businesses, you know, when you want to compare us to Alberta, even some of the Atlantic provinces, Ontario continues to fire on all cylinders. And I think this is not what the government expected. I mean, we're talking about, getting back to balance from what was originally a $15 billion deficit, and that's with a B, of course, to now 7.4. So revenues have actually increased. And so there may be less belt tightening because we're dealing really with a smaller deficit than was originally expected.
But so are the liberals right in saying, you know, the Ford government tried to make it sound like a crisis, but they actually inherited a pretty good economy?
Well, they did inherit a good economy, but I don't think that, you know, one can argue with the fact that spending was at an all-time high. I mean, if you look at the numbers, it was. It's hard to predict the direction the economy is going in. No one can predict higher than expected tax revenues coming in. So, you know, they are looking to do things differently. And any government would after 15 years of power from another party. So, you know, we've got that to deal with. But I do think the deficit numbers, I'm not sure any government could have predicted that it would be in half. And that's not to the liberal policies of the past. It's not the conservative policies of the last year. It's the fact that you know, businesses are continuing to pay taxes, continuing to employ, and the economy is doing relatively well here in Ontario.
One of the things that the government has come under fire for the last week or so. So we've had announcements on the one hand from long-term care about allocations for beds, and this after the Financial Accountability Officer came out with a pretty stunning report saying, even if the Ford government follows through on all their promises, these wait lists for long-term care are going to grow. And in the meantime, Andrea Horvath is up in the legislature every day saying, and this number is pretty eye-opening, she's saying in their first year, they only created 21 new long-term care beds. The government, Christine Elliott and Minister Fullerton, are saying, well, it's complicated, it takes time, we're working on it, we've made these allocations. So how important is that, Karen, and how much, you know, how much, who is believable in this?
Well, I think actually both sides are believable. And I not that I want to avoid taking an opinion on it, but 15 years ago, I worked for the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Long-Term Care on a project to build 20,000 new long-term care beds, because that was seen as the way of easing the backlog in the emergency rooms. So fast forward 15 years, the province has added more than 20,000 long-term care beds, and we still have the problems in the emergency rooms. So while we do need more supports for our seniors, and long-term care beds might be part of that solution, we still have a challenge understanding what is the reason that we're having the backlog and the bottlenecks in the hospitals that we're having. And I think that we struggle to figure that out, and we don't really have a good answer, to be candid, because we don't know. We've tried various things to clear that backlog, and we've not been able to.
Well, it's the growth in the population. I mean, people are living longer and they're sicker when they need care.
And when they get older and they're frail and they need more support, going home may not be an option, and yet the family may not be ready to be talking about long-term care. And so it's a complicated time of life, and the solutions aren't all there for families.
Alim, are they vulnerable on this?
I think they could be. I mean, if you look at, on the one hand, if you look at the wait lists that are projected to continue to grow, until this 15 or 20,000 bed comes into play, we do expect it. And I think all eyes are looking at the fact that even though the wait lists are going to peak, they will drop once the new beds come online. But
that, drop back to what they are now, 37,000.
Yeah, from 41,000. So yeah, they're absolutely vulnerable, and it is because we do have a population that continues to age, and that is outpacing really the growth of these new long-term care beds, and that is going to make it extremely tricky to make good on that promise to end the overcrowding. Now, this government's focused on putting resources directly at the front lines, and how they manage that alongside the beds that will be coming online is going to be something that I think a lot of people are going to keep their eyes on. Health and education really are it for the province. It encompasses almost three quarters of provincial spending here in Ontario. So Everyone is attuned to this. And I think at a macro level, how the health how the healthcare system is going to change for the better in the term of this government.
Michael, you know, every time the government gets up to answer a question, they're talking about the mess left behind by the previous government. That's pretty standard. But how much longer can they keep doing that?
Well, as long as it works and as long as it's believable, obviously. So I will expect that that is a chain of communications that's going to continue because the perception of the previous government is fairly baked in. One difference for this this government than other governments that have used that tactic is they now have an opposition that wasn't the previous government. So Andrea Horvath doesn't have to wear the mask of the previous government either. So
they're trying to put it on her, though. They keep talking about the Liberal government that she supported, however briefly.
That's getting too far in the weeds, I think, to really resonate with people.
Every answer today and yesterday on that issue of long-term care, that was brought up. The Liberal government that you supported, I don't know if it's having traction, but that's the answer. I mean, and mm-hmm. how long? I mean, isn't there, when is the point where you have to take responsibility?
Well, look, there's no statute of limitations on things like this, obviously, and government mismanagement, but the voters at some point are going to want to see results, and I think they're going to get that, and I think the province has done a few important things. Last week on long-term care, there's obviously many layers of building a long-term care space and a long-term care home, and to get one bed or to get 100 beds, this is a process that involves multiple levels of government. So last week, for example, we saw Minister Steve Clark use his authority as municipal affairs minister to change zoning where a municipality was dragging their heels and allowing a long-term care facility to be set up. So doing things like that are going to help. Other things that this government has been doing is we'll never be able to build our way out of this crisis. We will not be able to build to keep up with the current demand. So we need to also invest in community care and other things, which they are doing. So and programs to get people from hospitals to home instead of to long-term care. So as a holistic approach, I think within the next few years, certainly before the next election, Ontarians will start seeing results for their loved ones.
Karen?
Well, in answer to your question, how long can the current government keep blaming the former government? I think it's easy right now because the Liberals are really not, they're still in the process of rebuilding. And while they remain a 7 or 8 person party in the legislature without a leader.
A rump.
As sad as it is, but while they're still a rump party, they are still ripe for the kicking. And I think the challenge actually for the Conservatives is to remind people that the Liberals actually created the mess, because once they rebuild and get a new leader, then it will be a much harder position to take.
One of the things that we are expecting tomorrow, and I'm going to be discussing this in the segment that follows this one, is an overhaul of OHIP to make it more transparent. Where does that fit?
You know, that's one of those, I think, risky things, to be honest, because it gets into the, the e-health. I don't know if you remember the e-health scandal and the e-health records and how it was going to be more, it would be easier to transfer information from one provider to another. And in theory, it all sounds really, really very modern and progressive and helpful and transparent. But in practice, it is very complicated, and these projects tend to take on a life of their own.
The billings.
And, so it's one of those things that it sounds great, but how it actually gets done could be quite complicated and could be risky.
Michael, do you agree?
Yeah, it's not your standard disclosure of public sector wages like you see with the Sunshine List, because obviously with medical billings, there's obviously huge amounts of overhead. So I do hope that in media, I think disclosure is a good thing, but I do hope that media coverage of these billings are done responsibly to not create the politics of envy.
Aleem?
Yeah, this is a big issue. If you look at OHIP in and of itself, and I think this is going to come out in the fall economic statement. I mean, this is a $16 billion plan. When you look at OHIP, it is core to the government. It is core to how our doctors and other healthcare professionals get paid. And so I think the question really is, how do we look at ensuring that there is no misuse, and that you know, the services that are rendered and delivered, that's what is being paid for. And you know, how do we ensure that recovering funds, you know, when billings are incorrect, you know, how do we make sure that that doesn't happen? Like, there are a whole series of things that I think this government is focused on to make sure that the public is educated on what OHIP actually is, what it pays for, reducing the risk of fraud, and really at the end of the day, come back to the fact that the money saved around this will go directly to the front line. I think that's the vision of this government. And cracking down on something like this that is just massive in size, it's their vision, I believe, that they will find some savings and cut down on the misuse that, you know, inherently is happening, unfortunately, in Ontario today.
Okay. Finally, on the province, Doug Ford presenting himself as a unifier, not a hard-hitting kind of a guy, and offering to organize a premier's meeting here. I mean, do you buy the new Doug Ford?
Well, maybe, you know, in the 6 weeks that he had his time out, he had time for reflection and thought that there could be a better way to lead. And so I, you know, part of what I think makes it successful, and Michael, I'm sure you would agree with this, is that when a politician does something that's counterintuitive to who you think they are, it almost takes on even more credibility, because this is the Doug Ford we haven't seen that, you know, fundamentally, I think Ontarians would like to see in their premier, as someone who can work with people, who can get things done, who can fulfill this role. So, you know, I think whatever his motives are, if he can get the premiers together and start starting a conversation about national unity, then good on him.
Yeah, and I would add to that, if I can, that there is a chorus of support behind Ontario, and a lot of that is ideological, because if you look at, you know, Premier Ford's counterparts, you know, whether it's in Alberta, whether it's in Saskatchewan or Manitoba, ideologically, you know, these premiers are aligned. And so, you know, having him speak, about strengthening the Federation, is something that I think, you know, lends weight to the ideals and to the thinking of his colleagues in other parts of the country. You know, it's incredible that you're hearing the Premier of Ontario saying that, you know, we need to work together and think about the, you know, the hardship that people in Alberta are facing. He's also taking advantage, I think, of a minority government, and in his own way, for, you know, a prime minister that really campaigned against Doug Ford to get elected. We heard that name so much. This is the angle that he's taking to say, I'm ready to bring it together. And I'm ready to work with the prime minister. He said that yesterday in a transit announcement. It does seem a bit counterintuitive, but let's face it, this is the second largest budget and obviously the largest province in the country. So he holds a lot of weight. If he's able to pull this off, I think this is going to signal a premier that really wants to take Ontario and ensure that it continues to lead and is a key part of strengthening the Federation.
Michael, Doug Ford himself has said, hey, I haven't changed. And I've heard a lot of his, I don't know, in the States they would call them surrogates, saying all of that nasty stuff, that was all on his former chief of staff, Dean French. Is that your view of it?
Well, I think this is a perfect example of that, because I think, you know, the premier offering to get this meeting together is really a good thing. But if you look at the meetings he's held with various premiers quietly since the election, Premier Higgs and Premier Bowe and Premier Kenney and Palliser and King and Coulard, he really has already been doing this. So it's a really within his brand to bring people together. He's been hosting these meetings for over a year now, quietly, not making a circus about it. But I think the country definitely in need of the premiers to work together more strongly now than ever before, that we have a governing party that has two provinces where they have no representation. So I think it's really great to see the premiers coming together. And it's really more of Doug Ford doing what he's been doing since being elected.
Okay, moving to Ottawa.
Sorry,
now.
Just one one last footnote, okay. Though. But it is just a delightful way for Doug Ford to stick it in the eye of Justin Trudeau. Yeah. Because, I mean, he was his kicking boy for the 6 weeks of the election or so.
He was, and he was so self-controlled,
and
I
so
have
now
to say.
He comes back and says, I'm going to show you how it's done. And he's like, this is really a delightful poke in the eye that is telling Justin that he's going to do what Justin Trudeau was not able to do, which is to bring the country together.
Okay, that's an interesting take. And moving along to Ottawa. So yesterday, Elizabeth May stepped down as Green Party leader. Yes, she has personal reasons. She signaled before that she wouldn't be hanging around as leader much beyond this election. But it was part of it that she didn't really accomplish what a lot of people thought she should have, Karen.
Yeah, I think so. I think she recognized that her time as leader, she had done all that she could do. And if she couldn't make any breakthroughs in this final election, there needed to be somebody at the helm, because it really was an election for the Green Party. All the stars had lined up for this was theirs to take, and yet they still weren't able to make the gains that they had hoped. So I credit her for staying with the movement for as long as she did, but I do think it's time for a change.
Aleem, do you think somebody else is going to be able to do what she couldn't?
You know, look, she's had a impressive record, I think, as the leader, you know, notwithstanding the fact that there are only three seats. Keep in mind, that's actually growth from what they've had previously, from really being a fringe movement. We've seen the issues of climate change and even some of the indigenous issues that she's wanted to leave on, primarily from British Columbia, kind of enter the national discussion. So, you know, look, big shoes to fill for her. It's quite possible that they may go to the outside, you know, to look at somebody who's not, you know, part of the party apparatus to bring in and to lead the party. There's some opportunity with that as well. Lots of names have been discussed. You know, Jody Wilson-Raybould was offered the job, and apparently her name is still in the running as well for that. And it keeps that British Columbia presence alive, which, of course, is where Elizabeth May is from. But, you know, a little bit of time to go before we see who's going to be in there. What's really interesting is that a few days ago, I know that there were a few folks within the Green Party that started a petition that said that it is time for a new leader. And, you know, look, given she's turned 65, not to be age discriminatory to the Zoomer listeners, but, you know, it was really, I think,
not
time for
an
her
issue.
to look at passing the torch. And I don't think there's a shortage of people that she'll have, the party left to decide on is their new leader come next year.
Michael, so the lack of a climate change plan is one of the things that people cite as the reason that the Conservatives did not do better in the election. Is that going to contribute to this kind of knives are out for Andrew Scheer that seems to be happening now?
Look, I think the party is fairly split on that, so we'll have to see how the caucus meeting goes tomorrow, and if it gets to the convention in Toronto in April, where that goes. But I think you have Conservatives. It is a big tent party, and there's certainly members of the party who, I think, like Michael Chong, would like to see a different path forward on environmental issues. But for the most part, the base of the party, I think, would just say, we really needed to have articulated our climate plan better, not copy the Liberal or the Green plan.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the Conservatives did misread the country a little bit on the climate change initiative, and that the fact that they don't, it's not just that they don't have a plan, they're just not credible in that space yet. And so they need to do, I think, some soul searching about whether that space they want to occupy, and if so, how. Because right now, I don't think anybody believes anything they have to say about climate change.
And Aleem, do they have to get rid of Andrew Scheer, or is that just the old conservatives shooting at each other?
Well, you know, look, certainly the knives are out right now, there will be a leadership review that will be coming up. I think it's still a little bit early to call the shots on him. He's still young. I think a little bit undefined coming out of the election. People still don't know and are mixed with his personal views on issues versus party views, and I think that could cost him. But there is, again, with this party, no shortage of people that would be interested in taking a run at that job. We've seen the knives come out fairly early. I don't think that's unusual, for the party. It's a matter of time before, he has to really look inside and decide what he wants to do. This is a guy that's been in politics for a long time, for a relatively young age. He has been at this for a while. I think if they want to form a government, that is something they're going to perhaps have to take a look at. And in the same way as the Green Party, perhaps choosing somebody from the outside. We've seen what happens when you can choose a leader from the outside. We saw it with Premier Ford, somebody that wasn't an MPP, of course. That could hold some weight. Maybe somebody that's left who wants to come back, like a Peter McKay. So time will tell. But no shortage.
Time will tell.
No shortage of people that are chomping at the bit, I'm sure, at that job.
Okay. Sorry, guys, we are now officially out of time. Thank you so much to our strategy panel, Michael Diamond, Aleem Kanji, and Karen Stintz.
Thank you.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.